Hello, Podnutsians. Welcome to DDG Episode 9. This is Door-to-Door Geek. This podcast might end up being a little bit more random than your normal DDG. Also, I want to apologize for inconsistency, but I did say in the very first episode that there is no telling how often or how rare these episodes are going to be. I would first like to take a moment to thank a couple people for donating to Podnuts in the last couple months. First off is Joseph Kenzovich. I want to thank you very much for supporting Podnuts. He went over above and beyond with his one-time donation. We also have a bunch of people subscribed to our Patreon at Podnuts. We have a bunch of people subscribed to our Patreon over at patreon.com/podnuts. I want to thank Kenneth, Joshua Dennis, Stephen Gilligan, Rafi, Matthew Fuzzle. Again, Matthew Fuzzle, you're the man. John Hulledjinger, Abe, John, I butchered your name, I'm sorry. Jordan, Jesse, Andrew, RT Vance, Open Source Writer, SysAdmin Today Podcast, Paul Joyner. Go over to SysAdmin Today Podcast. Check him out. Great show, great guy, great content. He's also been on an episode of Podnuts Daily, I believe. Really, really good guy. I honestly would like to have more of him on the network. Also want to thank John, Matt Sharp, Cormac, Crosshaven Computers. Thank you very much. Ian Fox, Paul Bell. Now I believe I'm into repeating Patreon subscribers. So I want to thank all you guys for your support. I'm not going to lie, I'm genuinely shocked at how high that Patreon has gotten. I did not think we were going to see much growth with that over the time. We're already up to $56 per month. We are well on the way, in my mind, to having that Patreon be a great thing. We have a couple emails to also answer from Lucas. He replied to, I believe was DDG Episode 5. He said, I just ordered 10 of those 2-pack of USB LED lights you mentioned on the latest episode of DDG. While I don't necessarily have a studio to light, I can see finding several places that these will come in handy, and they are cheap too. Thanks for the suggestion. Yeah, and I will say one of my use cases for them, I don't know if I mentioned this, is for Halloween. Basically, I walk around with my kids for Halloween. I have a portable USB phone charger, and what I do is basically take one of these, stick it in the phone charger, easily lasts for 4+ hours, and by far the brightest thing anybody has out there. I point it at the ground, because I can't point it at anybody because it's so bright, so I point it at the ground. Makes it very easy for my kids and family members to find us among any kind of crowd that we might come into. To me, it is a safety thing, but it's an easy way for me to stand out for my kids. Another email I believe I might have answered already was from Jeff Owens, longtime Podnutsian. He asked me if I'm still using QTractor to do my audio post-production. He also asked me to explain the VM that we use and how I use it. Long story short, I use that virtual machine almost like a standalone application. I put my audio editing software inside of that VM, so I'm assured every time I start it up, it's going to be the exact same thing that I had loaded last time. Audio editors to me are pretty mature. I don't need any new features that I'm aware of. I don't need any new applications that I am aware of. I use Audacity, the lame command line in Encoder, and QTractor for my editing. I basically use Audacity to do noise cancellation, tweaking to specific audio spots. So if there's a spot that is a little bit too loud or there's too much of a pee popping sound, I go into Audacity, basically just using my sight, finding the high peaks, zooming in on them, and then reducing the amount of audio. I also use the Dyson compressor for certain audio tracks while I'm in that tool. I truly believe you got to use the right tool for the right job, and I do believe Audacity serves a very good purpose for me. Once that's done, I pull the audio into QTractor. I think of QTractor as more as a arrangement type software where I can put everything in the right order. The intro sound, the intro music, the main body of the content, the outro music, the outgoing self-promotion sponsor ad and things like that. I do use QTractor's built-in compressor, noise gate, EQ, tools like that. I also use the hard limiter. inside Q-Tractor, which ensures no audio will peak and distort. Once I edit the audio and export it out of Q-Tractor, I then re-import it into Audacity. I use Truncate Silence in that application, which enables me to do less editing up front, pace my podcast, especially a podcast like this. I take frequent breaks of 2+ minutes doing research, lining up what I'm going to talk about next, and I don't have to edit those spots out. I merely produce it all as one file with big blocks of empty sound in them, and then when I re-import the file into Audacity, I go to the effects menu, and towards the bottom I use Truncate Silence, which takes any prolonged gap or even a gap of a couple seconds and reduces it to a normal, in air quotes, length of time. So with very, very minimal editing, it is able to reduce the amount of the file size, the length of the file, and then I do a lame encoder to take the output from that and push it to a single mono MP3 track. The typical Podnut show, even when it's close to 2 hours, is still well under 100 megs. I am very aware of people's bandwidth caps. I'm also very aware of other countries and their speeds that they are getting. So the last thing I want to do is have a 200 meg MP3 file that's very difficult for other people to download. Besides having the focus of being a family-friendly podcast, we also want to make sure we are bandwidth-friendly to all sorts of people, including people in the U.S. who are on mobile plans who do not get unlimited data. On the very end of episode, I believe, Linux for the Rest of Us 209, on the live stream, I actually did stream the entire editing process. I will look at getting a direct link to the time in that broadcast and put in a link to the show so people can see the actual editing process. When I have good clean audio coming into the show and when I know what to expect, so the consistency of the audio quality is what it was the show before and the show before, my editing process is typically for an hour-long file well under 15 minutes. I will never have a workflow where it's a multi-hour process to do a single-hour show. That, to me, sounds a lot more like work and a lot less like podcasting and having fun. Thank you for the email, Jeff. Thank you for all the support throughout the years. Another email we had was from Todd about the app spreadsheet for Android App Addicts. DDG is a great way to contact me. It's the most direct way to contact me, I'll say that. And Todd opted for this. Todd is a supporter of Android App Addicts for a very long time, sending in many emails, many voicemails, and many communications. So I want to thank him for his support. Right now, the Android apps are listed in a Google spreadsheet. Nearly, I want to say, 4,800 apps we have reviewed on that show. We are almost up to episode 500, so about 10 apps each episode. I have had a couple people in the past offer to make me a web app. We've seen progress in that, and then life gets in the way, and it's pretty hard for people to dedicate time without getting paid to make a web app for a show. So none of them have been completed. Right now, the app list is still in a spreadsheet. I stopped putting the link in the show, hoping we would get this app up and running, but that has not happened yet. Anyone who wants a link, all you gotta do is shoot me a link. I'm now almost afraid to put it in the show, because now it seems like once every 6 months to a year and a half, Google does something with their internal Drive application, which makes all the public-facing shareable URLs change. So I don't want to put a link in the notes and have it, you know, anywhere from 3 weeks to, you know, 3 years later, all of a sudden break. So I did send Todd a link to that. If you would like to see a link of all the previously reviewed app, all you got to do is shoot me an email, ddg@podnuts.com. Here's an email from John. He says, "Hey, Dor, in the Mini PC podcast number 51, you said your provider gives you unlimited bandwidth and storage for $300 a year. Who is this and where do I sign up? I'm using regular home service, AT&T. I pay way more than that." I'm positive I said it wrong. What I meant to say was my internet hosting provider, HostGator. Does give me unlimited bandwidth. Podnuts.com uses right now, on average, more than 10 terabytes of data a month. And I pay roughly, I want to say, 300 and change for the hosting throughout a year. We pay on a 3-year basis, I want to say, which gives us a bigger discount. My home internet, oh, trust me, John, I pay a hell of a lot more than that. I only have 150 up, 150 down. I believe I have a 2 terabyte limit on my home network. And my wife and kids stream all night. I cannot believe we have not gotten any warnings about our usage, but we have not. I do believe cause my wife and kids also insist on having a lot of channels to pick from. I believe we pay well over $200 a month for our home internet usage. So yes, when I said my provider gives me unlimited bandwidth, I meant my internet hosting provider for the website podnuts.com. Okay, I believe that's all the emails that we have. Next topic is going to be about YouTube and monetization and adpocalypse. I'll say this from a podcaster perspective, and a guy who really tries to do as much research about everything before doing anything. I do believe there is a such thing as too much planning and not enough action, but I believe there is a sweet spot you should shoot for in life with all kinds of things. Back in the day, back in my day, YouTube was completely different. Every year or so, the YouTube topographical map, let's just say, on what you should do, how you should do, what are people's goals, how to get to those goals, if you're trying to make money on YouTube, how to do it and why to do it kind of thing, always changes. But there is a certain constant out there. One of the constants to me is to put your content on YouTube and then to complain about not getting ad dollars on it, or to complain about Google demonetizing your videos, or to complain about anything involving YouTube in reality, is to me much like going into a pool with a huge amount of children and complaining when you get splashed. What I really ask these people, what do you expect to happen when you give your time away, give your content away, give your marketing away, give your presence away to a corporation whose number one priority is to the shareholders, not to you? And to be quite honest, there is a million other people just like you creating content. There is nothing I can tell from any video I watch on YouTube that makes anything truly spectacular or truly special. I do not see anybody getting any special treatment on anything. This is a company with the number one priority and the only goal to make money for the shareholders, not to make content creators happy, not to make ad sponsors happy. It isn't about happiness. If it was happiness, it would be called a club that you join or a activity that you do. But you have a huge number of people jumping on YouTube, creating clickbait type titles on videos, begging you to smash that subscribe button, begging you to click that bell, become a part of the early notification squad kind of thing. And when you act scummy, because to me that's what it is, when you act that scummy, begging people to do these kinds of things without being honest to them with your main goal, as a creator, for most of these people, is not to create content. The main goal for these people typically is not to share knowledge. The main goal for these people typically is not even to meet cool people and meet friends and expand your own knowledge and your own horizons and come across things that you didn't know before. But these people's main goal is to make money. I don't understand how they can expect anything except what is exactly happening. When you don't own the platform, you are a product. This is why Podnuts has strived throughout the years, to own its own channels. We could easily put our content on all kinds of services, from SoundCloud to archive.org to Stitcher to yada, 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 on YouTube, yada, 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 all these different things. But once you give up that power, once you relinquish that control, you have no right to complain. Of course you have a right to complain, but you don't have any right to complain to me, is my logic. If you want to complain to Google, do it on your terms. If you really want to show Google something, get off their platform. There's other platforms around. And then if you whine and cry and say, well, if I get off of YouTube, I won't get the views. Well, then I'm sorry. You cannot have your cake and eat it too. The cream will always rise to the top. You will not be successful because you're on YouTube. You will be successful because what you're doing is good, period. There is no way people will only become successful because they optioned to be on YouTube. That's just the bottom line. Now, you can go to Twitch, you can go to Vimeo, you can go to all these solutions. There's also, you could host the content yourself, or you can pay somebody to host your content. If you pay somebody to host your content, you are now have a direct influence over that party on how you are treated. And if you're paying somebody to host your content, and then you feel like things are unfair, you feel like things are not being done right, you have a voice to speak with. That voice is your money. Okay. With so many people on YouTube, number two search engine in the world, with so many advertisers on YouTube, I don't even know, but I'm sure that number is insane too. How can you expect your voice to mean anything to anybody on YouTube? And even if you join a coalition, a group of 3,000, the top 3,000 people on YouTube, it's not going to influence anything Google does more than a single shareholder at a meeting saying something. That's just the way it is. That's the way money works. That's the way advertising works. That's the way marketing works. You should use YouTube like a tool because that's what it is. Podnuts has things on YouTube. Is it because we have to be on YouTube? Absolutely not. Is it because we want to be on YouTube? Not really. The main reason we use YouTube is because it's the easiest platform to stream and share our content to. Bottom line, if something else comes out tomorrow that is as easy to stream to and as reliable to broadcast to and have that backup copy of the audio in case everything goes boom, we're going to switch to it in a heartbeat, in a literal heartbeat. And for anybody out there creating content, relying on YouTube to be around tomorrow, relying on YouTube to hand you out a check next month, in my personal opinion, you're planning for a destructive failure, an absolute destructive failure. You need to, at any moment in time, be preparing to get off that platform. Because you need to get off that platform. You need to stop relying on that platform as a sole source of anything before that platform decides it doesn't need you. Because it's only a matter of time. At any point in time, any YouTube account can be turned off. And there's really very little recourse you have to getting it turned back on. So that's how Podnuts does it. Podnuts owns Podnuts.com. Podnuts is then accountable for Podnuts.com. Podnuts is responsible for the bandwidth, for how quick the server is, to how the graphics look, to how the software backend is, to how the advertising is done, to how the marketing is done, to how the presentation is done, to how the spit and polish is done. That's our responsibility. And to be very honest, we are damn proud of it. Okay. We are not just people who are just literally throwing content up there on somebody else's service. Expecting everybody to click us, to love us, to subscribe to us, and to smash that subscribe button. I feel sorry for people who have suffered from the adpocalypse. At the same token, I really hope they're using it as a positive tool to learn what to do in the future. If not, they're going to go through this whole thing again. It's just a question of how long, a week, a month, a year. It's inevitable. It's going to happen again. Plan for it. Just like disaster recovery inside of a company, you have to plan for it. doesn't matter if it's going to happen, because more than likely it will happen. It's just a question how severe it will happen and when will it happen. The more prepared you are, the less impact that disaster will have on your outcome. Podnuts right now has everything backed up like 3 or 4 times a week from our web server, the database, the files itself, and everything, just in case that one day HostGator might have real substantial problems and the whole thing could be down for 30 days. What if there's a massive disaster, fire, or something that happens in their main data center and it's going to be a while for their other data centers to be up to speed? It's possible. I would really hope HostGator would have better, things fixed, but it's possible. So I have to take it the accountability and the responsibility to have my stuff ready to go someplace else in case that happens. That's why right now Podnuts has its RSS feeds hosted on FeedBurner. It's not because FeedBurner's better. It's not because I like FeedBurner more. It's not because I trust FeedBurner more. I am using FeedBurner because right now I could have Podnuts infected beyond all belief tonight. Tomorrow I could put up a brand new domain called podnutspodcast.com. Hypothetically, I can repoint all the RSS feeds from feedburner.com over to that new domain, and every single listener to those podcast feeds wouldn't even notice an interruption in their podcast. Hypothetically, they wouldn't have to resubscribe. They wouldn't have to go looking again and then resubscribe. They wouldn't have a catastrophic failure in the RSS file not working. These are the kind of precautionary measures that professionals take ahead of time to try to avoid disasters before they even happen. Tomorrow, they might close FeedBurner. If they do, I'm in a lot of trouble because I have to immediately notify everybody to go to a different place to subscribe to the show. And it might happen tomorrow. We are taking precautions to that. We are planning on probably moving the RSS feeds within the next couple months, and it's going to be led by multiple announcements in every show saying that. And once we move those feeds over, I'm going to publish one last show to each one of those FeedBurner feeds saying that these feeds are no longer going to be updated. You'll only get that show in the old feeds, and the new feeds, we're going to keep on continuing like business as usual. Okay, we're going to change gears here a little bit. What I would like to talk about now, to be honest, is it's a new term I learned. Speech disfluency. Don't know if that's a real word. I don't know if it's been used the whole time. I just heard it not too long ago. Speech disfluency. To be honest, when I think about the word and I break it down in my head, I think it's a pretty accurate statement. I was listening to a podcast on StuffYouShouldKnow.com called How Stuff Works, I believe is the episode, and it was How Stuttering Works. Chuck and Josh, I believe, are the host of the show that I can't remember. They do a lot of shows on a lot of things. I most definitely do not agree with everything they say, but I will say they have some really interesting shows that I really do enjoy sometimes, and they're consistent, unbelievably consistent with their stuff, so I am definitely a fan of them. And on the show, they definitely said a couple facts that I consider to be real, and that's the whole thing. What I'm going to preface with this with is I don't think there's a single reason for stuttering to happen. I think there's a lot of different reasons it can happen to anybody. I also believe there's not one solution to fixing it in everybody. I think there is just as many paths to it being less of an issue. I'm also kind of sure it's very unlikely to have stuttering completely gone in your life after you've done it for a length of time. For the new listeners or the people that do not know, I stuttered unbelievably bad, is what I'm going to say. Unbelievably bad. From literally the first word I could speak up until about the age 30, which is right around the time I met my wife, is what I'm going to say. with me, I can tell you a brief history. I was born dead. I was born 3 months premature. Less than 6 months old, 12 Johns Hopkins doctors told my mother I was mentally retarded, because that was a term they used back then. Of course, my mom kept going to the next doctor and the next doctor and the next doctor until she got the answer she wanted. The 13th doctor said he's not mentally retarded whatsoever. He has very bad vision. And what it looks like is, when I was in the incubator after being a premature baby born dead, there's a set of hexagon lights above the incubator that I apparently stared at too much. And in one of my eyes, if I closed one of my eyes, open the other kind of thing, on a very clear blue day, or if the room has a very evenly lit white wall, I can see out of the side a little hexagon shape. And if I try to follow that shape, it's going to keep going over to the side until I can't see it anymore. And then I'll come back, and then I can see it again, and I'll go back over. When I was very young, I spent my time trying to see that. So I sat there my whole, like, infant youth, looking back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, trying to look at that thing, trying to look at that thing, trying to look at that thing. Apparently, I was OCD when I was an infant, too. And the doctor, like, covered up my one eye and showed my mother, look, he stopped doing it. Then, one of the next visits, my mom stated how I can't reach for things, how I'm way, way off when I reach for things. So when I was 6 months old, he also gave me a pair of glasses, which immediately helped my vision. I don't know how they can tell what my vision was, but the glasses I got did help my vision. So I was not doing that. But what the speech therapist, when I was young, believed, that movement, that repetitive movement that I did, I also would say single syllable things as I did it. So I was looking over, I was going da, 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 saying over and over again. So she believed when I was young that there was a mental stimulus there that encouraged the seed of my stuttering problem. And there's no way I can put this to you people. I can try to act right now what I remember in my head, how I stuttered. The one thing everybody, I hope, out there truly understands is memory is unbelievably flawed. A huge percentage of what we think is an accurate memory is typically incredibly inaccurate. But I can tell you, just to say a single sentence could very possibly, very frequently take more than a minute for me to say. Even if I just walked up to a fast food place and said, can I have a plain cheeseburger, could easily have taken me a minute. Very, very easily made me take a minute. Because I didn't only stutter, I also had blocks. There's different terms in stuttering. Stuttering is typically da-da-da-da-da-da-da when you say the same beginning or ending of a syllable multiple times. I also had blocks where I would sit there, especially on my name, have a hard time saying Stephen. And I'd and it was hard to get out. That's a block. And there's multiple different things like that in speech, in impediments. Thus, I did realize around the age of 15 or so, when I was pretty inebriated in a school parking lot or a school playground out in the backfield. And I witnessed shortly after, I realized, could have almost been a assault on a guy on a woman. And I knew both of them, kind of. We were in the same area. There was like six of us drinking and they were there. And when I saw his very pushy attitude on her, me being me, I did something. And what I realized after the fact was, when I did that, I didn't stutter at all. I didn't hesitate. I didn't have any issues speaking whatsoever. And I noticed that, and I picked up on that. And I was trying to make excuses on why I was able to do it. And part of me was saying, well, it's the beer. Well, it was the beer, because I was drunk. It was able to let me do it. Yeah. But that really wasn't it in hindsight. What I found was, I'll say this, I personally, when I look at myself, I believe I am a selfless person. I am the absolute antithesis of selfish. I usually don't want to do things for myself whatsoever. I would much rather do things making other people happy. To be honest, it's one of the joys I have in being a husband and a father, doing my best. Granted, I'm not always good at it, but doing my best, trying to make my family happy and my kids happy and my dad's happy and my mom, when she was alive, happy. And I found some genuine joy in that. And I didn't really do a lot of things for myself. Yes, I was definitely self-conscious as a kid. I definitely had self-esteem problems. I definitely had genuine depression. I still have some of all of that. I'm not perfect. But what I figured out in my late 20s was at least a good percentage of my speech disfluency was directly a mental thing. It was connected to my self-esteem, but it also was connected to my stress on how others perceived me. I constantly worried, if I said this, if I look like this, what do other people think of me? What must they think of me? How do they think of me? I will say the good thing, because you got to look at the good too. The good thing about having my speech impediment when I was young, or my speech disfluency when I was young, was it was a very easy way for me to quickly identify people I considered to be the biggest jerks, the most rude people that I've met were easily identified when I stuttered in front of them and the reaction I got from them. To me, it was very easy, and it might have been just my pre-bias. But not 99.99% of the people who, when I stuttered, would laugh or say, "What's wrong? You can't remember your name," or stupid things like that, turned out to be jerks I didn't want to talk to anyway. So there was good that came out of it. I will say that. On this podcast, How Stuff Works, they go into a lot of different types of speech disfluency, beliefs on why it happens, how it happens. And then what they highlighted, which I really, really appreciated, was what to do if your child or someone around you has a speech disfluency. And here's the gist of it. Do nothing. Don't give it any attention. Don't roll your eyes. The worst thing you can do is try to complete what that person is saying. That, to me, was one of the most discouraging thing I ever had happen to me, was I'd be trying to say a word and it felt like that word is getting ready to come out any second, and before I could say it, the other person would say that word. What am I working for? Why do I even bother talking if you're going to finish our word? It was infuriating, is what I'm going to say. Unbelievably infuriating. My oldest son, when he was young, now he's 12. Oh, he definitely showed signs of having a speech impediment. He might've just picked it up because, to be honest, I worry what my child thinks of me. So I actually have a little bit more of a speech impediment when I speak around my son. This is the most important thing I can have in my life. And the words I speak to him have a direct influence over his behavior and his thought process. That can be stressful. So I know I stuttered around him a little bit more from time to time. And when he showed a speech impediment, I did what I thought was the best possible thing you can do, which is absolutely nothing. If you're looking at that person in the face as they're talking and they start to speak, do not change what you are doing. If you're looking down at something when they start to have their speech impediment, continue to look down. Do not change your demeanor. Do not make a face. Do not roll your eyes. Do not suddenly look away or at them. Just keep doing what you're doing. The best thing to show someone with a speech impediment is that you are not even noticing their speech impediment. There is a lady at work who has a speech impediment, which much greater resembles myself in the past. And here's the thing. I know, because of my experience, she is not any less intelligent than the person sitting next to her without a speech impediment. And I see people treat her different. Not greatly different, not incredibly rude or something like that, but I see people treating her different. And when I'm in a position of power, this is the word I'm going to use, when I'm in the position of power at work, I don't stutter one bit because I know I am the authority speaking. They are looking at me because I know something they don't. In a lot of meetings now at work, I really don't stutter that much. So when I'm in a meeting with her, I honestly do what I can to, I don't want to say protect or shield her or treat her like a child or whatever, but if somebody completes a word that she's saying, I will immediately cut that person off because she is entitled to speaking it in the way she wants to say it. I don't defend her like some kind of shining knight kind of thing, but I definitely let people know, especially after the meeting, one-on-ones, that was really unprofessional what you did in there. And being someone with a speech disfluency, I will really appreciate if you do not do that again, ever. Because this is like one of the things, bottom line, nobody's perfect. I'm not perfect. The difference is my imperfection is obvious. It's a speech disfluency. There might be some kind of physical reason for it as well. Maybe my tongue is a little bit different. Maybe the roof of my mouth is also a little bit different, or under my tongue is not perfect, or that I have less teeth because a lot of them got knocked out when I was a kid by fist fighting and stuff like that. So I'm sure there's other things that are helping with the speech disfluency, but it's also a mental thing, and it's me. One of my core beliefs is now coming to at least my realization is there's so much in this world that is not exact. So few things in this universe are an absolute black or absolute white. So many things are at least some measure of gray. It might be almost white, but there's a little bit of gray in there kind of thing. And what I really mean is there is no perfection. There is very few things that are extremely expectable. Medicine, I believe, is one of these things where personalized medicine is going to be a thing of the future. It's going to be more popular and it's going to be more exact. It's going to be more speedy towards the individual patient. Our bodies are at least in some way unique. This medicine will have a slightly different effect on me than somebody else. Granted, it might be very minuscule, or it might be a little bit greater, grander. And the human body is always changing. So what this one aspirin might do to me, it might do twice the effect in somebody else. It might thin somebody else's blood even more. And it's just not been measured, so they don't necessarily know it. Just like speech disfluencies, just like solutions to speech disfluencies, there is not one answer. Just like if you have a weight problem, you know, there isn't going to be just one answer, not for everyone. I don't think, and nor do I even want there to be, a special blue pill that everybody can take that then everyone will have the perfect body, nobody will be obese, and everyone will not have heart disease. I don't really expect that day to happen. Because I do believe personalized medicine is going to become more real, where we will literally have individualized diet plans, individualized health regimens, individualized doses of medicine, because doctors and the medical establishment will know more about our individual bodies, how they act and how they react. So when I see somebody else with a speech disfluency, I don't assume it's caused by the same reason why mine was caused, nor do I expect there to be the exact same solution to a resolution as I have. I will encourage everybody who does have a speech disfluency, practice does make a difference. When I first started podcasting, you can listen to it. My very first episode on Podnuts Daily, I believe, was a 10-minute episode with me and Steve Cherubino, the original owner of Podnuts. Let me tell you something, it's a bit painful to listen to now. I definitely did not speak as clear. I did not speak as clean as I do now. It's partially because of the practice that I have. hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours doing podcasts. Without that, there's no doubt in my mind I would not be able to speak as clean in meetings, nor when I even go up to a fast food window and order my kid a Happy Meal, I would not be able to speak as clean. I now go to conferences, stand in front of more than 10 people. I think the one time it was almost 150 people inside of a room, and I gave my session talk in front of people, and there's no way I could have done any of that if I did not first feel dramatically uncomfortable doing it before. We all as people need to challenge ourselves. We all as people need to keep growing, keep getting better. Public speaking is one of those things where I truly, honestly believe if even 10% of us would practice once in a while, we would all become extremely better at it. A lot of people that talk have a lot of problems getting a pace going, getting consistency going, and not just standing there for a couple seconds and not saying anything. I can tell you, I've now been talking for over 20 minutes because I can look at the Audacity window with very minimal breaks in this audio, even though I said earlier I frequently take breaks. Once I get on a topic, I really don't have many speech disfluency issues, and to be honest, the words just seem to come. So whenever you can, I encourage people, give little speeches. I would love to have more time. I would love to go to more things like meetups. I would love to do more things like makerspaces where I could see doing these kind of things to be beneficial. Bottom line, listen to Stuff You Should Know, or SYSK. Listen to that podcast. Tell me what you think. I live off of feedback. I will say that. If you guys insist on having more shows, more feedback. If you drowned me in feedback, I will have no choice but to probably do multiple shows a week. So more feedback, better. Okay, some more stuff. I did a DDG, and it was a little bit about health stuff. I didn't go into a lot of details, and it was months ago. So this is what I'm going to say. Door-to-door geek. I used to use the word, I used to say the phrase completely wrong. I used to say a pit or a pendulum, which I don't know why I said that wrong. The correct term is a pit or a pedestal. Door-to-door geek is a pit or pedestal kind of guy. And what I mean by that is in everything in life, I am a pit or a pedestal. I either remember my wife's birthday and I buy her flowers and I buy her chocolates and I take her out to eat and we go to the movies and I do everything in my power to not have social anxiety, which I do have social anxiety around my wife. And just show her all the love and passion. And then there are years where quite literally it's the day of her birthday and I forgot to do anything. I'm a pit or pedestal. There's no between with me. Back on March 31st, I came back from Cambridge, Massachusetts, and I felt nasty. I felt nauseated, but I wasn't sick. I felt squeamish, but I knew I wasn't going to throw up. I just felt weird. I didn't feel good. I'm not a hypochondriac, even though in my head, I think sometimes I'm a hypochondriac. I just knew something didn't feel right. I'm not going to claim that I have some special connection with my body and I can feel these things coming kind of thing. I just knew something felt off. I don't know how dangerous of a level I was or if it was really early. I will just say I went to the doctors. I told them what I felt. For 20 years, doctors have told me I was borderline diabetic. Literally, since the age of 16, they've been telling me that. Since the age of 16, I've been drinking 2 liters of soda a day, pints of Ben & Jerry's ice cream, 2 12-inch pizzas for lunch kind of thing. With no, you know, just keep going. I drank so much soda when I worked in the warehouse lifting, you know, 50-pound boxes all day when in the middle of the summer heat when there's no AC, my shirt would have like white on it from all the salt being expelled from my body from all the sweat. That's how much soda I drank. I actually got shingles. The word is shingles. I actually developed shingles because my doctor stated because of my insane level of sodium I was taking in. I was literally eating like 4 packs of oodles of noodles a day, easily drinking 12 to 20 cans of soda a day kind of thing. So I had to stop eating Oodles and Noodles for a while. That's my pit and pedestal kind of thing. I went ballistic because they were cheap and I was saving money and I loved it. Okay. I was diagnosed as what is now, to be honest with you guys, a pre-diabetic. I'm telling everybody I got diabetes because if I say I have diabetes, there's less questions on what I do. So I've been telling everybody I'm a diabetic. I was diagnosed with pre-diabetes. On September 31st, my blood sugar level was extremely high, is what my doctor said. I don't have the numbers in front of me. I can tell you, like a week later, he had me come back in and take an, I believe it's an AC1 test. The normal AC1, they want to see your blood sugar. I believe it was between 4.5 and 6.7 are the two numbers they want you to be between. The first time I took the test, my number was literally, I believe, like 11.2 or 11.7, which was very much in the realm of you're going to take insulin shots. Your diabetes is so bad. Your diabetes is flaring up kind of thing. He thankfully didn't overreact. He then told me, okay, so, and he was very politically correct about his statements. He didn't want to say anything too sharply because I understand if he says something too sharply or too directly, I could take it as an attack, take it as an insult, you know, be besmirched, pull out my glove, challenge him to a duel kind of thing. So what he said was, what you really should do is you should cut out all the hard sugars and you should reduce the amount of white things that you eat. And then, you know, I asked him, you know, white things, you mean like bread? He said, well, bread, rice, and potatoes are three things you should reduce. He didn't tell me to stop eating them because he's afraid of what I'm going to say. So he didn't say to stop eating them. He said to reduce them. And then hard sugar, he basically said, if you look at anything and it's remotely close to candy, whether it be cake, frosting, blah, 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 you really need to stop eating it. Now, I didn't go completely crazy with this, but what I did was I basically started looking at labels of things. And on my smartphone, like if we would go out to Outback Steakhouse, I would simply say, okay, Schmoogle, Outback nutritional information, and I would get their thing and I would look at it and I would see what was lower on the numbers for me to eat. Very quickly, I realized the thing from school, I believe, where basically carbohydrates, I'm not going to say all carbohydrates, but most carbohydrates are nothing more than more complex chains of sugars. And when you eat carbohydrates, essentially, and yes, I'm picking my words very carefully, essentially gets broken down into sugar, which is why if you eat a lot of potatoes, breads, rices, sweets, sodas, stuff like that, you're more likely to develop diabetes. So knowing that now, it kind of made sense why I was pre-diabetic for so long. Cheesesteaks, pizzas, fries, you know, you'll have that. So what I'm doing now, very quickly afterwards, maybe a week or two, what I said to myself was, okay, I want to set goals for myself. And the first goal was something like less than 10 grams of sugar a day and less than 100 carbs a day. Very, very quickly, with, to be honest, help from my wife, I was able to manipulate that down to less than 3 grams of sugar a day and less than 50 grams of carbohydrates a day. What I'm led to believe is there's only a certain number of things that make up food. There's sugars and carbs, there's fats, there's proteins, and that's really the majority of stuff that's in foods. So for me to reduce sugars and carbs means naturally my proteins and fat intake will go up, period. That's just the way it is. I am eating less, but I'm also sure that my protein and fat has went up as well, okay? The good thing about the diet I am on, and I call it a diet I'm on, even though it's a misuse of the word diet. A diet, the definition of diet means what you ate, what you eat. That's it. There is no such thing as being on a diet. You always eat, so you're always on a diet. Means I can eat a lot of bacon, a lot of eggs, a lot of cheese, a lot of pork rinds, a lot of low-sugared bacon, beef, jerky, things like that. So it's not like I'm going without. There is Atkins-friendly type of food out there, too, where you can get these bars that have dark chocolate in them. Dark chocolate typically has no sugar or very low sugar. So I can still get that kind of sweet experience here like once a day, which is good. I also do protein type drinks in the morning where they have 2 grams of sugar in them. So quite literally, that's more than half the sugars I eat all day is my breakfast drink. And to me, it's just a nice way to start out the day with something other than water. I have a Ozark Trail, I believe is the popular brand, type tumbler cup. I believe 30-ounce tumbler cup. Got it off of Amazon for $6. The one I have right now, I have two of them. The one I'm using right now is a R-Tic, the letter R, -TIC, R-Tic cup, where I put ice in it, I put water in it, the water stays crazy cold, easily for 12 hours. Put it in a steaming hot car, easy 4 hours. Everything's still ice cold. That's how I like to drink my water, so I take in a lot of water. I'm a beverageholic. No matter what, I have to be drinking something all day or else I feel ridiculously parched. Ever since I was young, I would literally drink a gallon of milk, nearly a gallon of milk every day as a kid. I've always been a beverageholic, so now I'm drinking lots of water. That morning drink helps me out. And what it turns out is what I'm doing is, okay, I don't even know if it's a real thing. I'll say that. I mean, me no doctor, me no do actual research with this, but there's a state of your body, which at least on Wikipedia, it's called ketosis, K-E-T-O-S-I-S. Okay, here's the gist of what ketosis says. Ketosis is a metabolic state in which some of the body's energy supply comes from ketone bodies in the blood, in contrast to a state of glycosis in which blood glucose provides energy as opposed to glycose. Ketosis metabolizes fat to provide energy. Okay. I have no idea how accurate that is, how scientifically proven that is. All I can say is I'm eating, 2 to 3 grams of sugar a day, and I'm eating less than typically 40 grams of carbs a day, sometimes 60 grams of carbs a day. I've lost about 52 pounds in 6 months. Literally every pair of pants now, when I unbuckle the belt, they fall to my ankles. It's honestly, without sounding stupid, it's hard to go to the bathroom at a urinal because as soon as I unbuckle my pants, I got to stand all cockeyed and weird so my pants don't fall down. But that's how much weight I've lost. And I'm not going to be one of those people that say, I feel great. No, I feel exhausted. I feel unbelievably tired. I'm not eating any sugar, so my body is getting its energy from fat reserves is the way that I'll put it. I will say this is the kind of diet I told my doctor, and there is, I think, a good amount of truth to it. I can see myself continue on this diet for the rest of my life. I can't have fried chicken. Okay. I can't have French fries. Okay. I can't have fried rice anymore. Okay. I can't have a cheeseburger bun. I can't have a cheese steak. Okay. I can't have pizza anymore. Okay. I can't have a Reese's peanut butter cup anymore. Okay. I mean, I knew this years ago, 20 years ago when the doctors told me I was borderline diabetic. I knew there was a day where I was going to be restricted from eating certain things. So to be very honest with you guys, I personally, to a degree, said to myself, well, while I can eat it, I'm going to enjoy it. And I enjoyed it. I was over 250 pounds back in the end of March. I'm going to say over 250. I believe it was about 254, 255. I'm now just below 200, like 196, 197. And to be honest, when I was in school, I'm a short fella. When I was in school, I was around 145 to 155 at my heavy side. So realistically, I would like to even lose more weight. I would like to be around 170, 160, somewhere around there. And there's a side reason for it. I'm a pit or a pedestal kind of guy. When I was in high school, the years I didn't cut 140 plus days out of the 180 day school year, I actually was in cross country. I actually wanted to do that for a while. Partially because I was so used to running from when people would try to kick my butt in elementary school and junior high school. I was good at running. I was in a neighborhood where about half the kids were older than me, and when they wanted to let loose some frustrations, well, you know, there's the nerd with the glasses who can't see straight. You know, every time they would throw a right punch, my left eye was my worst eye. I could never see the punch coming, so I was an easy target. And to be very honest, at least one of the people in my neighborhood went to jail for murder. So it's not like I lived in a peaceful neighborhood. Let's just say that. So I was really good at running. I was able to run 2.8 miles in under 15 minutes. That's essentially running a 5-minute mile. So I was good at this running thing. Also, because of all the milk I drank, I have calcium deposits on my ankles and knees, which means they're a little bit more susceptible to injury. And I don't want to do exercises at a higher weight because I do believe injuries would come easier. I don't know if my doctor agrees with me because he's happy with the weight loss, or he agrees with me when I say that because there's some truth to it. I really don't know, but I know I'm going to lose a little bit more weight, and then I do plan on doing some sort of exercising. I am going to have to buy some kind of ankle lock is what I'm thinking. Ankle locks are basically like reinforced ACE bandages with steel bars going through them to help my ankles from getting sprained and slipping out of socket. That's how bad I've hurt my ankles. I did a lot of skateboarding as a kid, and I have a lot of damage on my body to prove it. So using the keto diet is essentially what it's called. I've been able to, I think, not be even close to in danger anymore. The last time I went and had my AC1 checked, it was literally 5.7, which I believe was perfectly in the middle of the acceptable range of glucose levels, long-term glucose levels. My doctor still asked me to go get a glucose meter, which I haven't done yet, but it's only been 2 days, where he wants me to take a glucose reading once a day. And what my friends who are older than me and wiser than me and have much more experience with this kind of condition tells me, what he more than likely wants is he wants you to take a measurement every day, record it every day, and in a couple months bring it in so he can see if there's any waves happening in your readings. And if there is waves happening in your readings, well, maybe you have it at bay, but it's still very prevalent. So he's going to continue me on my metformin prescription medication. But if it seems like it's constant at the same kind of rate, he will probably take me off that medication. I will say my doctor did say to me very clearly in May, less than 2 months after, you know, it looked bad, that he was very sure that the majority of improvement in my glucose readings and the drop in my weight had tenfold more to do with my diet than the medication I was on. And he kind of insinuated he was leaving me on the medication as more of a precautionary measure, and in which I can't blame him. I didn't know if I was going to be able to really continue on with this diet, so how could he possibly know it? Some people think doctors just want to keep you on meds to keep you on meds to make money. I believe most doctors want to keep you on meds so you can't sue them for malpractice, because we are as flaky to them as people are to us on Craigslist. That's what I firmly believe. So I don't blame doctors for keeping people on meds for an extended period of time till they are absolutely, positively sure it is absolutely, completely safe to take people off meds. And I'm okay with that. there's, you know, I'm not the guy who goes into a doctor's office and tells the doctor what to do. I'm not the guy that goes into the doctor's office and says, you know, doc, I saw this commercial for this medication that sounds like it's perfect for me. Because I don't have any years of training. I don't have any years of experience in medications and what they do, who they're from, side effects or anything. That's why he went to all the school or she went to. That's why they get paid more than me at my job. Doctors are supposed to get paid more than me. They have much more at stake. I'm a database nerd who works on servers and stuff. Much less critical. Much less critical. I'm okay with them getting paid money. Okay, now the ketogenic diet is something I actually first learned from, in reality, from Beyer Brown. If you don't know who Beyer Brown is, I'll say shame on you. Go on YouTube, look for Beyer Brown. You'll find Scanner Drone. That's one of the things he is affiliated with. Unbelievably nice guy. Unbelievably smart guy. And unbelievably charismatic is what I'm going to say. This guy could talk me out of my pants if he wanted to. I saw him post some things about ketogenic diet. Then it turns out one of the Patreon supporters, Black Death, also knows much more about the ketogenic diet than me. So I've been chatting with them off and on when I have time. And I'm not going full bore on the ketogenic diet. To really do the ketogenic thing, you really need to get like a, I want to say it's almost like a pH meter where you take your urine and you pass it through a thing and you measure, I believe, like its pH kind of thing. And it tells you how successful you are being at the ketogenic diet. I'll say my goal really isn't to be in a state of ketosis, but I'm very happy if that's the effect that's happening. Again, the only constant in this universe is change. So it wouldn't shock me if in 3 to 6 months, when my body is at a more normal level, that I do actually strive for this. And I actually do get the things and I actually do measure the compound in my urine to see if it is possible kind of thing. Because it doesn't seem like it's unhealthy to do so. When I told my doctor I was eating low sugar, low carbs, I told him the numbers, being a good doctor, in my opinion, he asked me about low sugar. He told me the symptoms of it, and he asked me if I ever experienced any of these things. And I told him, well, the only time I experience any sort of dizziness or even close to the word vertigo was when I would stand up quickly or be all the way bent over and come all the way up. And I told him that when that happened, I would pull out my blood pressure monitor because I have a blood pressure monitor. I am on high blood pressure meds. And my blood pressure was sometimes as low as, I want to say, instead of like 180 over 70, it was around 110 over, I mean, it was substantially lower than it normally was, is what I'm going to say. So he and I both agree it could be that and not low blood sugar, because it does very quickly go away. Literally every time I would feel a little bit dizzy, 5 to 10 seconds, it would be virtually gone. Another 5 to 10 seconds, it would be completely gone. So right now it looks like my body is in a state of ketosis. Right now it looks like I'm doing pretty good with my speech disfluency. Right now, as it looks like, I'm not relying on any outside source owning my intellectual property, owning my stream of content, deciding with me not in any equation how ad revenue is going to come, when it's going to come, and where it's going to come. Instead, I have great guys like Knucklehead Tech, like Marvin B, like Jeff Hallish, like Paco LeBron, like Martin Obando, like Cody Cooper, like Liam Tidwell, like James Passamore, like Chad Corey, like Jonas, like 8-Bit Brett, like Aaron Turnbull, like Mark Cockrell, like Eric Ardini, and everybody else supporting those who support you. I will do anything for anybody on this network. And I am so unbelievably lucky that they do the same for me. We have guys who are trying to find ad sponsors for us. We have guys who are trying to close deals for ad sponsors to us because they want to see Podnuts flourish as well. I have guys like Run Jump Stomp Bill doing his Switchcast, where I'm a sponsor to his show. I paid him money to mention my network. And I will say this, support those who support you. He was doing a show. He mentioned he was doing a single show. I harassed him. I literally harassed him in saying how he needed to do that single show again. He needed to do it. He needed to do it. He started doing it. I egged him on and said, you should do a Patreon. You need to do a Patreon. How are people like me supposed to support you if you don't have a Patreon? And I bugged him and I nagged him and I poked him and I prodded him. I hope other people did, but I know I was there and I was poking and prodding, and he started a Patreon. And I believe I was the first person to go and click that button and said, I support you, because he informs me with such good knowledge. He is very charismatic is what he does. He strives to be family friendly. He plays games and he talks about his kids' experience with them. I cannot ask for more as being a podcast consumer than that. So I figured the people who listen to his show are probably completely different than anybody who listens to anything on Podnuts. Why not get the name in front of them? So I made him an official sponsor. I'm going to do it at least a couple more times, partially because I like the guy, partially because he supports me with his content. So I feel like it's the least I could do back is to support him. Here is a quick podcast addict summary of just how much podcast I listen to. Now, because it's 12:02, it says I've listened to 0 minutes of podcast today. Well, that's right, but that's not going to stay the same for long. The real quick, I listen to my podcast at anywhere from 3x to 3.5x. So whatever numbers you hear, I listen to them 3 to 3.5 times faster than what it says. Yesterday, it has 8 hours and 48 minutes of podcast. This week, 1 day and 7 hours worth of podcast, 31 hours worth of podcast. Last week, 3 days and 22 hours of podcast. In the month of October, 5 days and 6 hours worth of podcast. In September, 16 days and 5 hours of podcast. I will take my OPML file from my podcast player and I will export it. It shows right now I listen to 127 different podcasts. Yes, I have a problem. Yes, I use Podcast Addict. And there's no irony in that. That's what I use. And if you like using Podcast Addict, I will encourage people go to patreon.com/podcastaddict. Yes, if you haven't noticed, this is one of the few podcasts out there that actually mentions other people's Patreons, because that's how Podnuts rolls. Go to patreon.com/podcastaddict and you can support the development of one of the best podcast players available on Android. I want to thank everyone for their support. Thank everyone for downloading. Thank for everyone who gives donations to Podnuts via the buttons right there on podnuts.com. And I want to thank everyone who goes to patreon.com/podnuts and decides to support this network. Without you people out there supporting people like me, we would all have to rely on systems and services like YouTube. And that would be a damn shame. Till next time, people. Thank you again.
Hey, this is Martin Abando from Geeksters on the Podnuts Network. Thank you so much for listening to the show right now and supporting the Podnuts Network. We can't do it without you. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, something that tickles your fancy you want to ask us about, you can reach out to us at geeksters@podnuts.com. You can always listen to us. We're going to be here all the time trying to figure out what's going on with the world of computers. And don't forget to be grunted out there. Thanks, guys.
Music provided by Steve Cherubino at stevecherubino.com.
I forgot Rich. I forgot Brian. I forgot Matt. I forgot Chris Carruthers. I forgot John Dubinsky. I got to stop naming people. I forgot Chuck. I forgot too many people.